Welcome back to Horse First. If you've been riding along this season, you'll know by now that this is not a show or a podcast about shortcuts or shiny answers. It's about mud on your boots, honesty. It's about hay in your pocket, reality. It's about looking a little closer at what's happening with the horse in front of us, even when the horse world would rather just keep things moving forward. Mid-season is where the deeper work starts to show, the easier stories fall away, and what's left is the real stuff. The habits we inherited, the pressures we didn't notice, the moments where slowing down is the most skilled thing we can do. So, if you've found yourself pausing more, listening harder, and questioning what used to feel normal, you're on the right track. I'm Lockie Phillips. This is Horse First. Let's keep going. Hello, everyone. I hope you're well out there in the world. Tough times we live in, and things might get a little tougher before they get better. So I hope you're all doing well, and not only doing well, I hope you're all thriving. And today's episode is a personal episode. And it's personal because I'm going to talk about one of my personal horses. In a nutshell, one of my personal horses, Sanson, my Hispano-Breton gelding, that is a Andalusian crossed with a French draft horse. It is considered not a mixed breed, but its own breed itself, its own type of purebred here in Spain. And I've had him for many years. I've known him for over 10 years now, and he's about to turn 16. In this last week, he got diagnosed with a disease called pyroplasmosis. This is a tick-borne illness, a parasite, a blood-borne parasite. And I'm going to talk about this diagnosis. I'm going to talk about what that means for me, for you, for this horse. I'm going to share with you what it was like to take care of him these last few years. And the whole purpose of this episode is to share with you my story so that those of you out there who maybe struggle to advocate for your horse in the presence of vets or other authority figures, such as trainers, farriers or body workers and more, I want to show you how important it is and necessary it is that all horse people that own horses, if you don't like the word own, we can replace that with the word steward or care for. Those of us who care for horses and are responsible for their well-being, how important it is that we develop the skill set to advocate for our horses and see perceived authority figures as equal to our expertise on our animals too. So let's set the scene. So you know the diagnosis, pyroplasmosis. I will go into more detail later because this episode is really about learning to trust what you see in your horse. And it's really all about what happens when something doesn't feel right, even when you might be told by authority figures that everything is fine. So the first signs that Sanson, or Sanny as I call him, was sick started in 2016, before I even bought him. He was living in an environment that raised many questions about the adequacy of the care. Read between my lines. I'm saying that I disapprove strongly of the sort of environment that he came from in every aspect, from the horsekeeping to the facilities to the management to the diet to the medical intervention. I disapprove, and that's half the reason, well, one of the big reasons why I decided to purchase this horse, even when I was in a life situation where purchasing a horse was extremely difficult and almost impossible to do so logistically, financially, but I did it before I was ready. And he got me ready real quick. So it started in 2016. So that's 10 years ago. He was living with another horse at the time, and that horse died one afternoon of sudden colic. And his previous owner was really attached to this other horse that had passed away. And so every time they looked out their window and they saw Sani standing there, they really missed the horse he used to live with. And for several years, this horse hadn't been working out. Sanson had not been working out for them as a business. And for several years, this horse had been getting along with me very, very well. And for several years, I'd been asking if I could buy him. So once his paddock mate passed away, they finally relented and said, all right, we'll buy him. And then what happened was a winter of severe health issues. He started having scourging diarrhea. And the vet at the time would administer buscopina, which is a control for gut motility and gut movement. They would administer buscopina, intramuscular, and advise removing him of all food for a period of 24 hours. So this protocol was used several times over the course of a winter. It was the only protocol used. And as a result, he dropped a lot of weight. Now, when I had seen him the previous year in 2015, he was a healthy, vibrant horse who would throw himself up the mountain with energy and with gusto. He might be a draft cross, but he was faster than all the Arabians and the Andalusians on the property. And off he went, charging about the mountain. And I returned to collect him in 2017. Yeah. So I returned to collect him in 2017, summer 2017. And the horse who used to throw himself up the mountain could barely get out the driveway. He had no energy at all. Now, my best assumption at the time was that he had stomach ulcers because he also showed indications for that too. So I treated him for ulcers. I started feeding him properly. And I nursed him that summer for 5 weeks. And we started, you know, doing very light work. But he was a shadow of his former self. He was about 200 kilograms underweight. And I put him on a horse box and traveled with him myself across Europe and took him back home to Poland. It was a four-day journey. And I went with him in the truck. And I remember staying over at accommodation stables in Germany and in Barcelona. And I had a little inflatable mattress that I set up as a cot outside his stall at the overnight stables. And I would sleep outside his stall. And I had anti-colic medication in a bag hanging above my head. And I would check on him every 2 hours. So an alarm would go off through the night every 2 hours. And I'd wake up and take his temperature and check his vitals. Because he was really touch and go on that journey. He was close to the precipice. Took him back to Poland, back to the place where I did all of my trainer and instructor qualifications, where they had amazing hay, lovely cool climate, herd turnout, and I nursed him back to health. He gained lots of weight. In fact, he became overweight. And he just thrived. And so I thought, okay, we've resolved the ulcers, and though his digestion was sensitive the whole time we were in Poland, it was more or less manageable unless he ate straw. And so we had a good time in Poland, and then I relocated back to Spain. I had to leave Poland, so I moved back to Spain, and as soon as he found himself back in the south of Spain, in the same climate where his symptoms began, even in the same village where his symptoms began, eating the same food where his symptoms began, his symptoms returned, and this time with a vengeance. And it was a very difficult time in my life. There was a lot of potential for me to start the guilt Olympics, feeling guilty for moving him again. And I thought it was the stress. I thought it was, you know, the move that had caused all of this. His transporter had said he traveled beautifully, he loaded beautifully, he got off the truck calmly. But a calm horse is not necessarily a non-stressed horse. In fact, it can be a sign of stress. But I digress. So I could have gone into the Guild Olympics, but I didn't. It was the situation I was in, and you just got to do the best you can with what's in front of you. It was inevitable that I had to leave Poland, and this is where we were. So over the next few years in the south of Spain, first his symptoms got worse, and then brought in a new vet, because I said, this isn't normal. We have to figure out what this is, because Buscopina is just not working. It's not working. And a vet came in, and we took some samples of feces and of blood. Blood came back good. And one of the fecal samples, we took a single fecal sample, and that came back apparently positive for something called salmonellosis. Now, salmonellosis is a salmonella infection in a horse, and salmonellosis in an equine, in most circumstances, would call for immediate euthanasia, because they are highly contagious. These horses, it's not if but when they will die of this disease. They'll be fine, and then suddenly they will lose weight, drop condition, and die. And so this was essentially a catastrophic diagnosis, and I had to keep him in a quarantine, and it was really, really sad and stressful for a while. But because he's my dude, I said, I'm not going to put him down. I'm going to see what I can do to manage this for as long as possible, because right now it's a problem, but he's still okay. My vet prescribed a medication to control his fecal water and his diarrhea, and that medication is called misoprostol. And he was prescribed 22 tablets per day. The most I ever used was 10. And for the last few years, we've been using this medication on again, off again, mostly on again, with maximum 3 to 5 tablets per day. And our vet here cannot believe that we are managing his symptoms with such small doses of this medical intervention. So we got the salmonellosis diagnosis, and at the time I was producing my first online courses and content, and if you go back and look at that content, you'll actually see me talk about this and explain that that's what he's got. And then I improved his diet, because my first online courses enabled me to buy better food, and the income from that, thank you everyone for supporting me at a time when no one did, the income from all of that enabled me to feed him a better high quality diet. And as the diet improved, he started gaining weight. In fact, he started to become overweight. And then his energy returned, never to its former glory, never to like he's running up a mountain. He would get to like an 80% of what he used to have, and then he would flatline. But we got to like an 80% of his former glory. And I was happy with that, because I was now really busy working and I only had time to get him to an 80%. And then the whole notion of 80% working sub-maximally became a philosophy. Then it became a practice that I transcribed into my clients' work, that there were benefits to working sub-maximally beyond what it could do for a horse's health. That working sub-maximally, meaning taking the horse to 60 to 80% of what you perceive they're capable of, and then not pushing, demanding, or insisting they go to 100. Actually, what that did was create an environment where my horses and my clients' horses could give feedback to us about where they were, what they could do, what they really understood, and this improved all outcomes for all my clients, meaning horses got safer, horses got sounder, horses became more relaxed, more connected, easier to care for, easier to handle when we started working submaximally. So that was really important. And after a while, my vet, who had given him the salmonellosis diagnosis, he was like, how's the horse doing? I said, great. Sent him a photo. He went, oh my God, he looks great. I'm like, I know. He's like, I want to bring some of my colleagues over, because I want to show them this salmonella horse that's like beating all the odds. So he was like a like an example. And next thing I know, my field at the time was filled with vets who were going, wow, look at him. He's just amazing. Like, what are you feeding him? What are you doing? We can't believe it. We can't believe it. And that's what caused me to go, does he have this disease? He should be dead. Does he really? None of the other horses he's been around have any symptoms. Does he have this disease? I would like to invite you to come and learn with me inside the EH School. This is a low-cost, high-value, flexible membership for horse people who want more than just quick fixes and louder answers. Inside, you will find a growing video library, a thoughtful off-social media discussion space, and live coaching calls with myself and often with my team, all designed to help you get to the heart of what's really happening in your horsemanship. This is not about following a method. It's about building clarity, skill, and confidence with the horses always placed as the first priority. If you're looking for a steady place to learn, reflect, and progress your practical skills without force of horses or overwhelm of yourself, I hope you will come and feel at home with us in the EH School. You can find the sign up by the link in the show notes, or you can visit emotionalhorsemanship.com and navigate to the EH School sign up. So I decided to do some research, got on Google Scholar, and I looked for efficacy of PCR fecal tests for salmonellosis diagnosis in equines. And up came a peer-reviewed paper that argued that a PCR test used to diagnose salmonellosis carried with it an extremely high incidence of false positive diagnosis. And that's all I needed to hear. And then the paper went on to say, what you should be doing is taking a minimum of 3 samples across 3 days of the feces, and you need to do those samples internally. So you can't take samples from the ground, from fresh droppings that fell, because that can contaminate the samples. And the sample that we had taken at the time was a fresh dropping that he picked up from the ground in an arena that my horse shared with chickens. Okay, so it's possible that that sample was contaminated from the environment. And had I not checked this, had I not decided to hold my horses and hedge my bets, or if I was a different kind of horse owner, Sani would have already been euthanized. But he wasn't. So I found a different vet, actually a breeder in Malaga and a vet. And I said, hi, introduced myself, explained to her the history, and sent a bunch of photos and videos of Sani. And this is going back a couple of years now. This is pre-COVID, right? And her first response was, that horse does not have salmonellosis. I went, thank you. I said, can you come here and inspect him and have a look? Let's do it. She came with herself and her colleagues, so 2 vets attended. And she said, look, this is what we're going to do. She's like, I don't think he's got this. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take 9 fecal samples, internal fecal samples, meaning you're going to need to get some anal exploration gloves and some sterile Vaseline, and you're going to have to reach in. And she showed me how. She showed me how to take the sample. She took the first sample and she said, you take the samples and then you keep them refrigerated. And then you need to pack the samples in an insulated and refrigerated on ice container and then ship it to this address once you've got 9 samples across 9 days. And that's exactly what I did. I kept the samples refrigerated. I froze like 4 or 5 ice blocks. I bought an insulated picnic hamper. And I sent the 9 samples to the lab where they did a bacterial culture test for salmonellosis. And one of the best days of my life was getting back a negative on that test. It was one of the best days of my life because it's like, okay, he doesn't have this life-threatening disease, Fantastic, fantastic. We can move up into the mountains. I can proceed with my career. He can be exposed to other horses. I can buy other horses. I can start a herd without contamination. Here we go. And then dot, dot, dot. Next thought was, so what does he have? Because I was still managing symptoms. Noticing that any stress at all would cause the symptoms to get worse. If I didn't exercise him enough and he became bored, that would be stressful for his system, and his system would weaken from lack of exercise and the symptoms would come. If I over-exercised and pushed him too hard, same thing, the symptoms would come. Fecal water, diarrhea, sometimes at the same time, sometimes only fecal water, no diarrhea, sometimes diarrhea, no fecal water. Plus, every now and then, this lethargy that would then recover, plus performance issues, getting to that 80%. And even if I asked for it gently, he said, I want to, but I can't. I was convinced my horse is saying, I want to, but I can't. And I would say, okay, I'm not going to force you. I laid down all implements that would force him to give more. And then I started talking about the importance of laying down implements that can force more and how that's important for health and soundness outcomes. I talked about whips and I lost friendships. I lost business opportunities. Leaders in the field stopped talking to me, erased me, ghosted me, stonewalled me. But I stuck to my guns, that it felt really important to do what I was doing and then to speak openly about it, not to project my problems onto other people, but to let people know that horse people and horsemanship is soaked in tools, techniques, equipment, and procedures and philosophies that allow people to force results whether horses should be giving that or not, and that this is dangerous for health and soundness outcomes. So what does he have? Well, through process of elimination, my vet and I believed that he possibly has irritable bowel disease, which is an autoimmune disease, not a digestive disease, autoimmune. So I stopped treating it as a digestive disease and I started treating it as an immune disease, and it became easier to manage. Once I could afford it, I started feeding him colostrum. I hired an equine nutritionist. We dialed in his nutrition. And then I relocated to the other side of Spain because I had realized that the food available in the south of Spain, which is essentially straw for horses, was indigestible and causing symptoms, and that the heat in the south of Spain was a stressor for him. He didn't like the heat. So I relocated to a more temperate and cooler region where high quality organic grass hay is grown in abundance next door to me. So I relocated, and then I realized, you know, gentle, constant movement and the ability to get rest at any time was important. So I built a farm where he could get gentle movement on a constant basis and high quality, warm, safe beds facing in multiple directions for different wind scenarios. I set those up and his health has become so much easier to manage since I relocated to the northwest of Spain. So for the last 3 years, we've been here and his health has been easier to manage. And I feel like the feeling of trying to hold it all together against the stresses that we experienced in the south of Spain was also contributing towards pushing back against his disease. And then when we landed here in Galicia, it's taken a couple of years for his body, for his nervous system to realize, I think this is home. We're not going anywhere. And a little bit like how you'll be healthy for months and then you go on holiday and you get a cold because your body relaxes enough to let it happen. I think that's what happened. His body relaxed enough to let it happen. And it's not only metaphysical, that might be the most unscientific explanation for what happened over the last 2 weeks or the last 2 months even. What really happened also is that in January, I looked at my supplement bill and I looked at my horses and I said, boys, I'm so happy that you're all so healthy, but oh my goodness, we have got to do something about this supplement bill. How many of these supplements are actually still working for you? How many of them are still necessary? So considering everyone was really good, really healthy, looking great, feeling great, relatively, Sani, again, was still getting to that submaximal point, not able to go further. And in fact, over the last couple of years, his ability to work for extended periods of time or to spend lots of energy has slowly been reducing. And so we stopped going on trail rides because I'd take him out on a trail ride and he would just be exhausted. And we were on flat, easy surfaces. And I thought, is he just getting older? Like, is he getting older? Is there something wrong with my training? But then I'd take him into training and he'd be really happy to be there. Anytime I asked him for an energy-saving trick, he would throw in with gusto. And anytime I asked him to do something that was effortful, he would try and then pull back, try and then pull back. It was like someone trying to get off a sofa and they couldn't. And instead of forcing it, I just accepted it. I would give him extended periods of time off and then slowly bring him back into work, build his strength up. And again, his strength would get to a certain point and then it wouldn't make sense. We couldn't get past it. And I thought maybe my cult was reason why he was so tired. But none of the other horses were as tired as he was, and they were all doing the same things to help raise my colt, such as lots of play. And then, but they were also resting. It didn't make sense. So everyone was looking good, except for Sani's sort of gradually diminishing energetic capacities. I also had people advising me that it was metaphysical, that there was, you know, a psychic and spiritual connection between me and this horse, and that he was tired because I was tired and I needed to rest. And that felt like spiritual gaslighting to me. That's just what that felt like. And again, I didn't feel hostility or animosity towards people who advised that. I understood that their intentions were really good to say this and that that was their perspective. But it just felt like spiritual gaslighting, because I know that I draw a very good line in the sand and I've got spiritual boundaries, energetic boundaries between me and my horses. And if anything, the evidence I had on the table was that every time I worked with him, he would be better, and that when I didn't work with him, he would be worse. And so I was convinced that there was a medical storyline that we still hadn't come to the bottom of after all these years. Navigating this diagnosis involved interactions with dozens of vets over a 10-year period. Many things were missed, many things were minimized, and many things remained unclear. And there was a consistent thread throughout these 10 years where I, as the owner, needed to push further, push on my vets by asking more questions, standing my ground, catching them before they got in their car and went to the next emergency, because most vets are. And again, I'm not critical of vets. I think the heroes, you know, all of them, even the bad vets are heroes, you know. They are so valuable. Vets are valuable, but they're not infallible. I see my horse every day. They see my horse occasionally. So I see myself not as below my vet, but horizontal to them, working with them, right? That's about navigating diagnosis. It's a horizontal relationship with the vet, not a hierarchical one. So the last 10 years has required me to stand horizontal to a vet who many people feel they should never question. And I would question them, not question them, but question what we were dealing with and say, no, I insist we test again. I insist we look at this deeper. I insist you come and help me, because I'm telling you it's not right. And often people would say, don't worry, don't exaggerate, don't be dramatic. And I would say, I'm not worried, I'm not exaggerating, I'm not being dramatic. I'm telling you, I might not be a vet, but I know my horses and I need you to listen to me. And I need you please to do this. So anyway, back to the supplements. Looked at the supplements and said, guys, we can't keep spending this. So I started reducing some of the supplements to just to see, which ones they still needed. And if they needed to go back on them, I would. So for Sani, I reduced his colostrum by half. And then I removed the renal and hepatic, so the kidney and liver support that I had kept him on for the last 2.5 years. So I removed that altogether. I did that in January, and by February, his symptoms accelerated. He started sleeping more. He started yo-yoing on his weight. Now, because he's a draft horse, many people look at a skinny draft horse and think they're fat. But I know him and I know how to assess a horse's body condition free from biased eyes and breedism. And I could see he was losing weight. So we would feed him more and he would stabilize and then he'd lose weight again. I thought he can't be playing that much with Oki because he's spending most of his day sleeping. My interns at the time would come inside after feeding and say, Sani's sleeping again. I'd say, again? He was basically covered in wood shavings most of the day. I'm like, let's put a rug on him. Heavyweight. It's not that cold. Heavyweight rug on him. Let's open up the gauge size on my feet, like hay nets, to a bigger hole. Let's get this food in him. Let's up his feed. Let's give him oats. I hadn't given him oats since we used to ride 8 hours in the mountain and when he needed sport food. I'm like, he needs sport food to walk, you know, 2 kilometers a day around my flat track and sleep? What's going on? And so called the vet, of course. I said, look, he's dealing with something and it's chronic. I said, I've known him 10 years. In 10 years, he's sick. He's got irritable bowel disease and we're managing it, but something else is going on. I said, he used to work really hard in the mountains. What if it's chronic pain? Let's x-ray everything. So we x-rayed everything. X-rays were almost perfect. A couple of small issues, but nothing clinically conclusive to explain what he was dealing with, meaning whatever issues he had were minor, and in fact, all of his joints everywhere in his body were better than expected for a horse of his age and mileage, which I was thrilled of. And his blood work came back actually better than mine. So my vet said, what do you think it is? I said, what do you think it is? He says, actually, I don't know. I said, well, look, maybe it was just a really hard winter, and maybe my colt is that hard to live with. Poor Oki, right? So I started working with Oki to kind of get him a little more balanced, and he did, and fed him more and watched him waited. And then 10 days ago, I had another intern on the farm, and we were in a lesson with Sani, and Sani was just quietly stopping us from proceeding. Sani would get to not the 80%, not to 60%. Sani was getting to a 30 to 40% of what I know he's capable of. And he would quietly, calmly, peacefully just stop. And this was so consistent. And if we hadn't had those trainings where we could hear that from him, if we had avoided working with him altogether, we wouldn't have seen this. So I put that data point in my mind. We had also been keeping a body temperature diary of him. And we noticed that anytime he went through these sleeping phases where he'd be sleeping for hours and hours at a time, that his body temperature would fluctuate within healthy range. He's always at 37.5, 37.4, 37.6. That's his body temperature. I know that from years ago because I've done body temperature diaries for him. And if you've got a horse out there that you think is chronically unwell, start a body temperature diary now, start a symptom diary now, start a behavioral diary now so you can start building in your mind like a supercomputer around your horse's health that's objective rather than biased. So his body temp when he would be tired would drop to a 36.9 or go up to a 38.2. It would go up and down, up and down. We'd rehydrate him, put more water in his mash, give him more food. He'd bounce back and his temperature would stabilize again. And then it would flare up again and he would go to sleep. Until on Easter Sunday this year, 2026, he was in the bed. And then I was working, looked up, he was eating, working, looked up, he was in the bed. Working, looked up, he was eating, working, looked up, he was in the bed, I said to my groom, I said, how many times has he been in? She said, three times. Three times since this morning. It was midday. He's been in bed three times and he would sleep for half an hour to an hour at a time, get up, he'd eat for 30 minutes, go back to bed. And I said, did he have wood shavings in his tail this morning? She said, yep. So I said, so he's sleeping overnight and now he's sleeping again. I said, this is not right. Not right. And I had actually organized for the day after Easter Sunday, for Monday, for the vet to come back. I'd said, vet, look, I'd like you to come back because we did an x-ray his neck. So I want to check his neck and his elbows because I'm not convinced we've got it. He's still not right. So I called the vet on Sunday. I said, look, I know you were planning on coming tomorrow. I'm sorry to call you on Easter Sunday, but he's down. He's not colicking. This is not colic. He's literally just asleep. And it's not normal. And my vet said, okay, I'll be there this afternoon. Bless him. And when he arrived, Sunny was in a full body sweat. It was a warm, see, unseasonably warm afternoon, and he hadn't shed out his coat yet, but he was warm and sweating. And the vet looked at the sweat and went, that's not normal. I said, he's lethargic. He said, yep, this is not normal. I said, you agree something's wrong? He said, yes, I agree something's wrong. I said, what do you think it is? He said, I don't know. I said, let's test him for metabolic stuff. We've tried that before. Nothing was conclusive. Let's test him for metabolic stuff. Let's check the blood again. And my vet got right underneath him like a mechanic under a car and looked at every patch of his skin, lifted his tail, body temperature, everything, looked at everything, could find nothing. Sent blood off. Blood came back positive, pyroplasmosis. I said, what? Pyroplasmosis? Why hadn't we checked that before? All these vets, 10 years, no one's checked this? I hadn't thought to check for this? The EH school is a quiet place in a loud industry. It is a low-cost, high-value membership that I've created where horse people can come and slow down, think clearly and build real skill with horses at the center. We have an expansive, already very deep video library, an off social media discussion space, and live calls with myself, where you'll get direct support that feels, I hope, steady, practical, refreshingly human, and often really fun. This is not a system that we are creating for you to obey, but a craft that we want to help you practice it. Come and join the Emotional Horsemanship School, the EH School, and you can find the link in the show notes of this episode. Now, I could have gone to the Guilt Olympics, but I know that that's a waste of my time. And I know I'm also not a vet, and my job is to push with questions and ask for diagnostics. The vet's job is to correlate and corroborate that information into the best possible diagnostic pathway. Now, I said to my vet, did you check for pyroplasmosis a month ago? He said, yes, and it was negative. So my vet said, he's got an acute infection. I said, no, he doesn't. He said, it's acute infection. He was sweating when I was taking the blood. I said, I know, but that was a hot afternoon. He said, it's an acute infection. I said, nope, he's had this a long time. Because this explains everything. The symptoms of pyroplasmosis, fatigue, lethargy, diarrhea, performance problems, fast gut motility. And for years, we've been basically treating this disease through diet, through lifestyle and symptom management, and low stress handling and training that doesn't exacerbate inflammatory responses in the body. It's basically an equine version of Lyme's disease. Now, he's not directly contagious to horses. He's not directly contagious to dogs or to me. The tick is the taxi. The tick would have to take his disease to another horse. And we are testing all my other horses. Blood was taken today. So the vet's convinced it's an acute diagnosis. And again, I stood horizontal to him. I said, no, it's not. I said, listen, 10 years I know him, 10 years he's sick. I said, do you remember 2 years ago when there was a lump in his neck? And you said to me, don't worry. I said, I'm not worried. I want you to take it out and test it. We tested it and it was malignant salivary gland carcinoma, mate. He said, yes, I remember that. I said, and then we took out the distal salivary gland, tested that, and that was negative. I said, because I pushed you. this horse averted cancer. Now, I was worried that he was laying down and sleeping. I'm like, did cancer get into his body? But we tested him and it looked like we had gotten the carcinoma early and gotten all of it before it had spread anywhere. But that's what I was actually worried about, was cancer, not pyroplasmosis, cancer. And the vet looked at me and he looked at me really calmly and he really analyzed what I was saying. And he went, okay, well, I'll trust you. He said, I believe you that it could be chronic. Said, so in that case, I will take more blood and I will send it not to the local laboratory here in the northwest of Spain, but I'll send it to the head laboratory in Madrid, in the capital, one of the best testing institutions in the country. And we'll check to see what type of pyroplasmosis this is, because there are two types. There's a bad one, like, and a worse bad one, right? And we'll test to see if it's chronic or acute. So again, this detail for testing, he wouldn't have just done that without me pushing for more information. And I thought, for how many years has this been happening? Where I'm worried about people pleasing, I'm worried about being seen as a hypochondriac, pushy helicopter horse mother, right? When what I should have been doing was pushing. Anyway, shoulda, coulda, woulda, didn't. So those blood tests came back and it's positive for thylaria, which is the chronic and worse version, the bad version of pyroplasmosis. And, quote, said the vet, not a recent infection. I kind of said to him, I told you so. And he was like, okay, yep, right, let's test all the other horses. Meanwhile, he started treatment. Today, as I record this podcast, the last vaccination is going in. I've had to be very good with my vaccines. Intramuscular, I can do. Intravenous, I was less good at, but I'm good at intravenous now. What can I say? Because over the last 9 days, the first round of treatment has involved over 30 syringes. I will not share what medicines we're using. There are three different types of medication that my vet prescribed, and I'm not going to share that because I'm not a certified equine vet, and I don't want people to listen to this podcast and start making irresponsible medical choices. I'm not trying to gatekeep the treatment. I'm literally trying to prevent people from making inappropriate medical decisions. That's not the purpose of this podcast, is to give you a treatment protocol. It's to treat you as people who can push for better protocols from your vets. But I digress. So, you know, immediately starting the treatment, he's already doing so much better. He feels better. He's sleeping less. And thankfully, one of the medications that can have immediate serious colic if you give it, right? So on administration, it's got recorded side effects of immediate and serious colic. Thankfully, he hasn't had that, touch wood, this time around. Now, it might take several rounds of treatment, but my vet believes it's treatable and that we might be able to kick it to the curb. And now I'm wondering, all the things we did and achieved, and he's been living with this, what is he going to be like on the other side of this treatment? Is he going to get a new lease on life? Are we going to be able to run again together? Are we going to be able to gallop again together? Is he going to be able to enjoy excursions off the farm because he's got energy to do them? It's amazing what could happen on the other side of this. And as I record this podcast, I'm watching him underneath my window have a nap while he's going into systems upgrade mode. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for every single vet that's ever cared for him, whether they diagnosed him properly or not. I'm grateful for every single vet that came in and tried. And I'm grateful for my persistent ability to keep pushing for answers when something doesn't feel right. Because horses, their bodies whisper before they shout. And when they shout, it's already too late. We need to remember that owners will often see problems before vets will. So many things I noticed before a vet noticed it. And that's the way things should be. That's not a problem. That's actually the solution. Small things didn't sit right with me, and that feeling in my gut never went away, even before anything was confirmed. And I don't know for sure right now because I'm still in the middle of this process, but I'm fairly confident that this is a Hail Mary diagnosis for my personal horse that could lead to a total new life quality for him. All of these interactions with my vets, they were all professional, they were all studious, they were all caring, they all tried. And yet things were missed, minimized, and unclear because vets are valuable, but they're not infallible. They see my horse occasionally. I see him every day. You are not below your vet. You are horizontal alongside them. I want to encourage anyone listening to never hesitate to advocate for your horse in the presence of a perceived authority figure. And I know so many authority figures will push back on that, particularly, unfortunately, to women, but not only, right? I've had vets look at me and say, don't worry, don't exaggerate, calm down, he's fine, right? Because they're used to seeing so much worse, perhaps. Or they're just busy running to the next emergency and my horses don't really appear like they're in an emergency. So what does it look like to assert yourself respectfully? That's to stand your ground. It's to listen, nod your head, say, okay, but, and this is what I'm noticing. This is what I'm noticing. And I'm sharing that information without exaggeration. This is what I'm noticing. And I need you to hear me when I say that something is not right with this horse. And I need us to look at this more carefully. Google Scholar is a great resource. It can help you understand diagnoses very quickly. And it's a good idea to do a little research, not to be Dr. Google, but to research through the internet. You know, we have the World's Encyclopedia at our fingertips at all times. And, you know, research, what sorts of tests should I be testing for with this array of symptoms? And you can ask your vet, can we test for this? Can we test for that? Was it a PCR test? Was it a culture sample? What sort of blood tests are we doing? Is the laboratory doing the tests equine specialty, or do they specialize in, this disease? Have they diagnosed this disease successfully before? Is this a lab that does people? Is this a lab that does all sorts of livestock? Is this a lab for small animals or large animals? Or is this an equine lab? Have they diagnosed this before or have they not? Is this a familiar diagnosis? Have you diagnosed this thing before? Is this the first time you've diagnosed this? Have you seen populations of horses that have this disease before? Have you checked tick-borne illnesses? Have we checked blood parasites? Asking questions. Asking questions and seek second opinions. Don't rush to accept the first explanation, but listen to the first explanation and take that into account as you ask for the next information. You are allowed to advocate and you are responsible for advocating, not at fault, but responsible. And every minute we spend wallowing in fault and guilt and listening to people who say your horse is ill because you stress them out, this sort of spiritual gaslighting, when we listen to that, plus allow ourselves to feel guilty thinking, well, it's because I don't care for them properly, or whatever the storyline is, we're wasting time that we could be using to actually advocate for a correct diagnosis and pushing forward. Management, training, nutrition, lifestyle, and care become part of the response. Care is treatment because it looks like the facts on the table I'm now contending with. It looks like me and my horse have been fighting single-handedly with maybe even our hands tied behind our back. We've been fighting a life-threatening, serious diagnosis, potentially for 10 years in multiple countries, by pure virtue of low stress training and handling that never forces an outcome to the point that the horse feels that they're egregiously extracted upon, the best diet I could offer at any given time, and medical intervention for symptoms of the disease, low level plus high quality naturopathic supplementation. And he got to an age and a lifestyle where the body couldn't keep fighting it this way. it's kind of blowing my mind to realize what we've been able to do and how far we've been able to get without the full diagnosis. And so it reinforces again the importance of good feeding, good movement, good environment, low stress levels. Treatment is not just clinical, it's daily care. So during the active stages of the treatment for the Filaria version of pyroplasmosis, we have opted to keep him out on the track system and not put him in a stable. I think many people probably would put the horse in a stable, make them rest. What we did do was put hay nets in my sleeping shelters. And I have a policy of never putting hay in the sleeping shelters unless the weather is raining sideways. Then we put that in the sleeping shelters. And what happened is all the horses were resting with him. They would escort him to bed, stand around him in the bed, and everyone would power down and go into systems upgrade mode. Like everyone was spiritually shifting it with him or feeling it with him, empathically shifting it with him. That's what it looked like. But it could have just been everyone taking a nap. And putting hay nets in the sleeping shelters meant everyone was sort of hovering around the house, which meant I could keep my eye on him. It was like a large open plan horse stall, right? And if they or he wanted to get up and leave and go to the other side of the farm for some food, they could do that too. So we kept the beds really clean, fed in the bed the last week, so he didn't have to spend energy to get calories and he could rest immediately. And of course, water's always available, etc. And I pulled back on training during the active portion of the treatment. And my student, who's here at the time, what we did was shift her lessons to other horses. And then whatever we did with Sani, it's like, okay, I'm teaching you how to do intramuscular injections now. You're not going to do the intravenous, but I'll teach you how to do intramuscular. She had never done that before. So pull back on training, but tomorrow will be first day after treatment and I will quietly, gently start building him back up with the submaximal principles and practices that have been key to our success all these years. So the care hasn't really shifted that much and it's been amazing to watch this farm turn into a rehabilitation and convalescence space so easily without having to change everyone's routine and without having to separate or isolate. And yep, we've taken blood and we're testing everyone for this disease. And if anyone else comes back positive, we will be treating them also, whether they're symptomatic or not. And it makes me wonder out there, how many horses are just underperforming, not because there's something wrong with the training, but because there's something wrong with diagnostics. I travel the world and I meet a lot of horses that people believe are over-emotional or difficult, and not only travel the world in person, but deliver services all over the world online. I mean, yesterday, I taught in Japan, Australia, Florida, Slovenia, and somewhere else in the United States. That was just one day. And what I've noticed is that horses who are truly healthy and free from discomfort are actually willing, cooperative, easy to handle, safe horses that are willing and able to simply learn with us and work with us. And that horses that are showing resistance are not always in a training scenario. Often we do have horses who are showing resistance because they're just not properly handled yet. And we look at that. But whether they're not properly handled or dealing with a diagnosis, well, both of those situations require proper handling. So it's moot point. But so many horses I've seen and worked with, I believe they're dealing with something that's undiagnosed. And I'm always signposting horses in those directions. And I wonder how many people feel resistant, blocked, ashamed to keep exploring that in the presence of authority figures, trainers or otherwise, that just think it's a training problem or think it's a technical issue or think that the owner isn't good enough or they're not strong enough, firm enough, or the training's ineffective, whatever effective means, you know, makes me wonder. And so that's why I'm here, to record this podcast, to share with you my story, because I want to bring it home really clearly how important it is that we do pay attention to our horses and see what you're looking at. Trust what you see and don't be afraid to speak up, because you know your horse better than anyone. And your job is not to defer. Your job is to advocate and to care. And the best outcomes are going to arrive when you stay engaged, not when you step back. I want you to feel empowered, not afraid. Please feel empowered, not afraid. Thank you for being here. I hope this helps someone somewhere. And if you would like to send Sani your well wishes, you're very welcome to. However, let me just gently set a boundary as I'm sitting here speaking to the void of the internet. What I'm not looking for is advice, medical. I'm not soliciting anyone's medical advice right now. I really do trust my vet. I trust my eye, and I trust we're on the right path. I'm not looking for any medical advice, homeopathic advice, spiritual advice, energetic advice. I'm not looking for that. Please refrain from it. But your well wishes are very welcome. Yes, I'm not looking for things that are unhelpful for me at this time, because we're on the right track. Yes. But if you'd like to send your well wishes, I'll read them out to him. Yeah. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to seeing you soon. Take care now. Bye.